town people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. A world dismissed as conspiracy by those who want to keep its secrets hidden, exposing the dangers, denials, and deceptions. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.
Welcome back, folks, to this hour of the Hagman and the Hagman Report. Up next, Stan Dale, standale.com. Folks, our Hagman Report store is open, hagmanreportstore.com, and we're inaugurating it with not only Greg Jackson earlier, but with Stan Dale today. That's hagmanreportstore.com. Browse. Go ahead and browse. We have more in store for you. Pun intended. Stan Dale from standale.com. Stan, glad you're feeling better. Welcome to this episode.
Absolutely better. I was telling you in the break there, yesterday morning I got up, I had a really bad night, and as soon as I got up out of the bed, all of a sudden, all the pain left. It's weird. And I thought, must be a turn wrong or something, but must be a lot of people out there praying for me, because turned a switch, and for 2 days I've been, you know, virtually pain-free.
Amen. That's great. I want to thank everyone for praying for Stan. And we know many people have been. We've been getting emails and saying, you know, I'm praying for Stan. Hopefully he'll be on the program. And here you are. So it's good.
Well, I felt it was something miraculous. I mean, believe me, I've been several weeks with this really bad pain from the fall. And then before that, I'd had, you know, pain that comes and goes. But this was just beautiful. I it's like my mind was able to work again. It just wasn't cramped, you know, with the pain.
Pain has that paralyzing effect on you know, mentally. It's more than a distraction. It's difficult to work, difficult to concentrate when you're in constant pain. And I'm glad you're better.
Thank you, sir. Well, what are we going to talk about today? Not much in the news, is there?
Folks, go to standale.com. You got to go to standale.com and click on the show images there, because when you do. Yeah, there's a few things there to talk about. You start wherever you want to start, man. This is your time, whether it's... and I was thinking about you. The Colorado, or the tornadoes in Colorado, you okay? Did they brush... Obviously, I'm not good with geographical areas outside of my own realm.
No, they're
realm,
out to the east. Most of the tornadoes skip right over us because we're up snug up close to the mountain range. And they go out and annoy and harm the farmers out to the east of us in the flats, you know, heading toward Kansas, which is famous for tornadoes as well, you know, like in the Wizard of Oz. But this particular tornado, I don't know who the guys were that were driving the SUV and filming this thing. Some of it's been on the network news. But I've got a link on my show images page to about a little over 5 minute video the guys made of this tornado as they chased it. Definitely crazy guys, but anyway, they got so close to that thing there that you could see a secondary tornado forming around the main tornado. I got a little snap of it there so you can click on it and see the whole 5 minute video. But it's some of the best video I have seen of a tornado, and especially that close. mean, you know, it's a wonder they didn't get caught up in it because of the speed and the size of it. Tornadoes are a fascination of mine because back in, gosh, 69, 70, I was doing research on how tornadoes work. And it inspired me to develop the, flying tornado saucer, the flying saucer. But it was a tornado that enveloped the craft. And it worked just like the real ones did, or do, you know, the tornadoes. And that's what, of course, you know, eventually got me sent down to Australia with Dr. Teller's group. So tornadoes, they're just a fascination for me. They don't suck things up the middle. The people got the wrong impression. It's not like a elephant trunk that sucks things up. It's in the middle of a tornado is moist, warm air flowing downwards. And the only vacuum is in the wall, the outside wall of the tornado. That's why when it grabs things in the vacuum, cars and posts and all kinds of things stick out of the tornado as they're caught up in that funnel, because they're in the outside edge of it, and they're not up inside the funnel. And so the warm moisture comes down, it's charged, there's lightning flashes inside the tornado tube, and this hot warm air hits the ground, splashes, and forms this disruptive kind of donut around the bottom of it, and starts to spin back up the outside of the warm column coming down. And this is all, you know, ion, charged ions that are doing this. And you'll see that they form this spinning vacuum wall up to the top. And when you look from the air over where a tornado has been, there's circular cuts, not fill circle, but like a circle outline, like a razor cut in the terrain as these things move along, because that's where the vacuum is in that very thin wall of the tornado. But anyway, there's another fascination that we talked about it to a couple weeks ago on the show about how a huge form of that sat over the top of Israel when they were going to make the crossing of the Reed Sea, and it blew this nice warm easterly breeze across where they were camped on the other side of the where the Suez Canal is now. And it dried the ground and pushed on the outside of it, pushed the water up and around and over out of the area where Israel is going to walk. So tornadoes, very, very interesting study. Have fun, go click on that and see that video. It's not mine, but I just thought it was extraordinary. So well done. My hat's off to the guy.
Looks very crazy. We're watching it on the screen here, and it definitely looks intense, that's for sure.
You know, Stan, I don't think I'd be driving into that. I'd be pedal to the metal in reverse, but that's just me.
Well, it was that. What was that movie, Storm
Twister.
Chasers or something like that? Remember that movie?
Yeah. There were a couple of them. I think one was Twister.
Yeah, I thought they were crazy then. You know, when a cow goes flying by in front of your vehicle and you're not worried, there's something wrong with you. There's something definitely
exactly.
wrong with you.
Yeah, but, it's amazing footage to be sure. Go ahead, sir.
Now, listen, a fun thing. I'll get the fun thing in here in the beginning. Someone sent me a link to a newspaper article in the Daily Mail in the United Kingdom. And it's a series of photographs, part of 1,000 photographs of the Holy Land that were taken by a couple of photographers in 1850 through 1860. And these are the old, you know, sepia-toned, you know, tintype-type photographs. Mainly what we're seeing here in this link that I've got on the page is pictures of Jerusalem. And you can see the Al-Aqsa Mosque, you know, when it was, you know, ratty and not up to date yet. And you can see a Bedouin warrior there with his gun, and people walking down the streets with their cloaks and their wares and stuff. And it's just really a fun little thing to look at. I can step back in history. Well, what would that be now? Like 140 years, 160 years, something like that. And see how it looked back then in Jerusalem and some of the surrounding territories. You'll see some Bedouin women and then some Bedouin men all sitting around something they're eating there with all their sandals off and using the right hand because that's the clean hand, because the left hand is what you know wiped your backside with and stuff. And there's a warrior with a big saber and his rifle and stuff, and it's all Lawrence of Arabia type stuff, just, but it's all real. Just really, really good to see. Anyway, I put that up for people to enjoy. Now, a couple things in news. Did you guys cover the U.S. military being at its lowest level since 1940?
No, but how important is that? Especially in the context, too. People believe in martial law. I personally believe in executive police force action and supplemented by external forces. But please cover this, because I think contextually it's extremely important.
Well, it made, you know, Fox and other people mentioned it, but when you get down to the nitty-gritty of it and get the stats, which I put up on the site there, the second row, the second, third photographs are graphs, you see that in 1944 and 45, we had between 8 and a quarter million Army personnel in active duty to fight World War II against, you know, Germany and Japan. It was a two-front war. And then, of course, after the war, everybody went home, and you see in the graph that 1951 through about 1956, Korean War, and the maximum number of guys we used there at one time was about 1.8 million, and then it dropped back down to over to Vietnam, and we had about the same number of active duty personnel during the period for the Vietnam War, and not shown in this graph so much of it because defense spending. Reagan built up the military and, you know, Star Wars type stuff in the 80s. Where we are now, we will have maybe 440 to 450,000 active military personnel, and we're fighting a war in Afghanistan. We've got peacekeeping actions in near Iraq, some in Europe. We've got the threat of the Russians eating our lunch. We've got ISIS. We've got the whole Middle East crisis, and we've got not very many people as active military personnel. And even if you're using, you know, super smart weapons and satellites and all this kind of stuff, you need people and backup people to support and run that. We've just been run down to number-wise to a point that's ridiculous. Now, if you look at the second slide there, the second row, second slide, it tells you the defense spending, actual dollars and its percent of the gross national product, gross domestic product. And that tells you another side of the story. In the Korean War, you know, it was around 17-18% of our GDP was spent on defense. In the Vietnam War, it was slightly less. You know, when you look at the which curve am I looking at here, the dark blue one, you're looking at about 8% of our GDP. It fell down during the Vietnam War, and it fell even lower during the Reagan buildup in the 80s, 81 to 1988. And then it really dropped down toward 2000 to maybe 3 or 4% of our GDP was spent in defense. Then we hit Afghanistan and jumped up to nearly 19%. Now where we are, sorry, not 19% to 5%. I was looking at the wrong graph. Anyway, now we're down to about 2.5% GDP. You know, and it looks like it's going to be flatline or lower, depending on who's in office between now and 2019. So they spent money, increased money, for these actions, but didn't increase personnel to the point that we did in the mid to early 40s for World War II. But I think we're in worse shape now, you know, as far as threats than they were then. Even if it's domestic policing of terrorist activities, we need more bodies. And they're just not doing it. It is just, I'm sure the White House could probably justify this somehow or another, but if you ask the Pentagon, do you think this is a good idea, you know, the answer would be a definite no in four-letter words, I'm sure. They're just taking our defense away. The administration is giving us to our enemies. I just cannot believe I'm sitting here watching this happen.
To what end, Stan? I mean, aside from the obvious, is there some absorption intended? This new world order, which everyone, or not everyone, which many had thought was this
conspiracy theory. Are we? I mean, what's the larger plan here? We can see the obvious, but what's the larger objective here? Is it simply to defang us, or?
No, it is. It is not simple. What they want to do is they want to have a global government, the planners. But the United States has so many people with independent thought and weapons that America has to be financially crippled and put into chaos to remove it as a potential weapon of defense for Israel and the Middle East, because Israel and the United States at the moment are closely allied in spite of the administration. And with a change of government, should it happen, we have the weapons to make it hard for a lot of the Arab nations and Turkey and Russia to attack Israel, because we've got the nukes and we could use them. So we have to be totally reduced to no military or no action can be coordinated, because we're in chaos internally. And once they have beaten us into submission that way, I'm sure Russia and China have plans to move onshore and put boots on the ground here to occupy the United States. And, you know, there have been a number of Christian prophets that have had dream visions of this, saying, you know, where they will land and how long the invasion will last, but then they'll eventually leave. Everybody will go and leave the United States because there won't be much left to live on. It will have been destroyed by the weapons of war and the sickness that spreads from it. So it's a bigger plan. And we have been kind of the policemen of the world since, you know, World War II ended. De facto, and you know, when you got to get rid of the cops here, you're the police of the world when you want to do something naughty, and they're wanting to do that in the Middle East, and everybody's got a different agenda over there. Russia's got their own agenda, and Israel's got their own agenda, and Saudi Arabia's got theirs. Everybody's got an agenda. ISIS. Now, ISIS is an interesting thing. Do you know that most of the terrorism in the world, most of the terrorism in the world comes from Saudi Arabia? They finance. Yeah. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, it's the Wahhabi Sunni doctrine that fuels ISIS. Well, that fuels the... Yes, it's that doctrine. And we established Saudi Arabia, we meaning the West. And
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, the Wahhabis are a very... basic, you know, no-frills, basic Islam. But there are a number of articles that are published about the joint deal between the House of Saud and the Wahhabis, where the Wahhabis, I don't know how to say that. Well, anyway, you know, post-Ottoman era, the Wahhabis, who are very basic Islamists, have been passing laws to behead and delimb people that were Muslims, but not strict, you know, to the Quran. Now, the Saud family are thought to be not pure Arab stock. There are a number of articles being published about this, saying that the Saudi royal family are really Israelites that were left over when Israel wandered in the desert, when there were occupations, and the 10 northern tribes left and were taken into captivity, that even the tribe of Dan was over in Iraq, and they're saying that the Saud family are descended from an Iraqi citizen who was a tribe of Dan and changed his name and pretended to be an Arab merchant. There's a lot going on there in Saudi Arabia, and we have to watch them, because if they're behind, which they are, if they're behind all the terrorism in the world, then we have to say they're behind ISIS. They've got the money to fund ISIS, which, you know, the United States helped them to arrange for the deal in Syria, but it got out of hand, and the Saudis are in control of, you know, the post-Bin Laden-type group of terrorists. So if they wanted to, the House of Saud could hold back the funding and get a hold of the leadership of ISIS and say, okay, that's enough now, stand down, and we'll put you in reserve till we need you again. Now, the world is afraid of ISIS and the terrorists. They don't know how to beat them. You know, they infiltrate and they become illegal migrants in the various countries in Europe and here. And they do terrible things. They're going to do a lot more terrible things here in the States soon. So how do you beat that kind of stuff? You throw money at it, you throw all kinds of stuff, and they still get through. And then you have a White House here in this country, which is opening the borders. And, of course, Germany opened its borders and let the Syrian migrants come in as well, which were a lot of them young men that were suspected terrorists. So we have no way in the Western world to really effectively stop the invasion of these terrorists. However, if the head of the Saudi family, who controls the money and organization of ISIS under the covers here, if he says, okay, guys, stand down for now, make me look good, you know, we'll make a public deal and you'll stand down, it won't be terrorists anymore, and I'll be a hero and I'll give you great things if you do that. This is how it can happen. And the Saudi leader, who has gained so much power in the last year, is the guy, Mohammed bin Salman, the deputy crown prince, number two in line to be the king. And I don't think he's going to become the king of Saudi Arabia. I think he'll remain a prince in charge of all these portfolios, because he's the one that has been organizing the 39 Arab nations into this Arab Union to make a military machine. They've already run joint exercises, you know, early in the year, what we talked about. As I understand it, there's going to be an invasion of Israel at the beginning of the seven-year tribulation. And that invasion will fail. And probably the leader of the invasion will be hurt as a result of it, or in his own country be hurt by his own people. I think we're going to see the Saudis attack Israel with a consortium. But I think Israel is going to surprise them all with nuclear destruction that will astound them. They'll lick their wounds and go away. Now, remember in Revelation it says there are going to be two beasts. The Antichrist is the first one. The second one is the false prophet who says, make an image to the first guy because he was wounded with a sword to the head and he was dead and yet he lived. Now, if you get a head wound from the sword, you're probably not going to be the full quid. You know, you're not going to be all there, you know, even though you come back. And I suspect that's why the second beast, the false prophet, runs the numbering system, and he runs a lot of the stuff that we blame the Antichrist, because he's making it in the name of the Antichrist and having people honor him who caused the, you know, the peace to come by getting rid of ISIS. But, you know, he tried to do the right thing to as far as they're concerned, to get rid of Israel, and failed. Now, so that's why I was asking in a break about the Gog-Magog war, Joe. And I see in the scripture in Revelation where it says after the 1,000 years, Satan is released and he organizes Gog and Magog to attack Israel again. I know there are other debates that say that there's going to be the invasion at the beginning of the 7 years and an invasion in the middle, or at the end of it, in the middle, I think it is, and then there's going to, of course, be the Armageddon War. So I don't know. I tend to think that you're right, that the Gog-Magog thing will come a lot later. But anyway, we're going to see shortly something happen, and the House of Saud is going to be involved in it, and they're going to be behind a great attack on Israel. I find this interesting because the king before Salman, you know, young Mohammed's dad, the king before him in Saudi Arabia, actually funded Netanyahu's run for prime minister in 2015. He put a lot of money into it to get him elected as prime minister of Israel. Why? I don't know. It doesn't make sense, but you'd think that would be his enemy, but he financed that. And then I started digging into the history of the Saud family. And back in the 1800s, early times for the Saud family starting, the house, or the Wahhabism, was just in its infancy then. A Jesuit priest came to the king of Saudi Arabia and said, look, recognize the Wahhabi guy. It's a good thing for you to follow Wahhabism. Now, why would a Catholic Jesuit priest come and tell the king of Saudi Arabia, adopt this type of Islam, this fundamentalist type? Well, you know, that puts some kind of a nondescript link between the Vatican and, you know, Islam in Saudi Arabia. Now, isn't that weird?
Absolutely strange indeed.
And we're seeing, in my view, and I think what you're getting at is this cooperation between the Vatican
right? And Islam, which it doesn't make sense at its face, and until you start deconstructing the components and seeing the larger picture, I think is what we have to do.
We've got to have a global government and a global religion under the Antichrist and the false prophet. Now, that means Islam and Christianity, and of course, you know, Buddhism and Hinduism, all the rest have got to come in as well. But the two major factors, they have to agree. And behind the scenes, we're seeing this. I mean, even former Prime Minister of Israel, Shimon Peres, you know, last year, the year before, met with the Pope and talked about, let's have a world religion. Now, for a Jew to say that, that's traitorous. That's treasonous, right? I mean, that's just an anathema. Now, today, talking about, you know, these three or four religions that are vying for power here, go to Turkey, and, well, you can link to a Turkish leader, parts way of the EU, on the third row or fourth row down the right-hand side. You see Erdogan shaking hands with, I think it's Angela Merkel, or somebody there, looks like her. Anyway, he is not going to follow the suggestions of the European Union as far as handling the immigrants, the illegal migrants, the terrorists, whatever. He is going to pull out of the EU. He's also putting forth a paper to his government, to his people. He wants to change, make a new constitution, a legal constitution for Turkey. In other words, he's going to change the law. Now, is he going to be the false prophet who picks up after the Antichrist gets wounded and can't do the job efficiently? Is he the one that's going to make an image to him and you know, cause the numbering system and all the stuff that we blame on the Antichrist? Is Erdogan going to be that guy? I mean, he considers himself, you know, the new Solomon himself, but I mean, his name isn't Solomon, but he's an egotist. He's got an ego that's, you know, 10 feet tall. I mean, it's big. And if he's going to change the law, the next he's got to change the times. You know, I don't know whether that means a calendar or holidays or what in Turkey or for the world. But watch him. You know, in the wings, Erdogan is being groomed to be part of this, I think, as part of the second beast. And we know that the harlot that rides on the beast is the Vatican. It's just come, you know, through the ages, and that's just definitely it. But I'm just seeing things happening so rapidly with these heads of state that we have very little time left to wait for this to be, for the Antichrist to be revealed. And it may be that what we're discussing here is revealing him. But he has to actually do a couple more things before you can put the stamp on whoever it is and say, that's the bad dude. But all these pointers, even the Wahhabism, the terrorism coming from Saudi Arabia, young Prince Salman gaining so much power and shaking up the world by taking Saudi Arabia off the dependence on oil and going to other commodities and things to make their mark, including a free energy type thing. Now, did he get that himself, or is this a gift from the aliens at the Jabal Tuwaik base I told you about? We knew that we had aliens there in Saudi Arabia, 120 miles outside of Riyadh in the Jabal Tuwaik mountain range. And young Solomon, his first governorship was for Riyadh, just 120 miles from the base there. And if he did liaise with those aliens, or they did with him, vice versa, and give him access to free energy technology, that might be why he's divesting himself of his oil holdings, and they're going to surprise everybody and come out with free energy for the world, you know, for a price and a number, I suppose. But there's just a lot happening that are pointing, things are pointing to Saudi Arabia being the center of this Antichrist-type movement of our time. They behead people. Saudi Arabia leads the world in beheadings for religious persecution or whatever, or legalism.
Scripture.
I hate
the Bible.
Say again.
With scripture and the Bible, that is illegal also in Saudi Arabia. And going back to what you said about changing the laws and changing the times, when you say that, that always reminds me of what the Catholic Church did with the Sabbath in instituting it on Sunday. And,
right.
You know, that's just what comes into my mind when that's brought up. Doesn't mean that there aren't other changes that are coming or could come
that are related to that. But
well, you know, without regard to that, Stan, as your a good kind of measuring stick would be your appearance here on our program on a weekly basis. Now, here it is in 2016 May. How far have we come? How much ground has been covered, or how quickly has this accelerated, we'll say, over the last several weeks, several months, in your estimation?
Well, this year has seen the rise of, two very important, very possible candidates for the Antichrist in the last, 5 months, not even 5 months, from woe to go. Young Salman gets to power, and he's 30 years old, and if the Antichrist is going to follow like the image or the path that Jesus followed when he was 30, he started his ministry, and it went for a little over 3 years, is our Antichrist going to do the same thing? And Erdogan's too old for that, but Salman would fit that bill. And he's just gained so many portfolios of power within the country there by his father's grace, obviously, King Salman. But their jaws dropping as they watch him in the press taking over the Middle East and Saudi Arabia. They call him the young millennial entrepreneur. Of course, he is young and he is a millennial. But he's not letting grass grow between his toes. This guy is definitely out there doing all kinds of stuff, remaking the Saudi culture. Give women the right to drive. I mean, you know, heaven forbid the women should be able to drive and vote. But anyway, he's going to let that happen. And he's also proposing to open up Saudi Arabia to tourism, believe it or not. Come see us. I thought to myself, yeah, leave your Bibles at home and don't say anything wrong. You'll end up headless over there. It just, you know. But he plans to make money with tourism, probably from Arab countries, Muslim countries, and not from the West. But it's moved very fast. I just cannot believe what I'm seeing.
Well, it does give you cause to pause there when we're looking at this from an aerial view, from a cruising altitude, looking down and saying, okay, you know, how much has changed?
Anyway, so, there's going to be a little bit of strife between him and his cousin, Mohammed bin Nayef, who is the crown prince, who is technically supposed to take over when the king dies. But the king has been shoving all these portfolios over to his son. And the only way I can see that Salman could be the prince of the covenant would be if he never took the throne in Saudi Arabia, let his cousin take it, and bin Salman went for the seat for the whole planet, and thereby, as the head of the world, he could tell the king of Saudi Arabia's cousin how the cow ate the cabbage. You know, you do what I say because I'm in charge of the whole planet. So that might be why he remains a prince in his own country. Don't know, but that is a thought. I've got a link to on another subject here. There was a former White House advisor gives a video testimony on a YouTube type thing. Link to it and watch it. This woman interviews him. He was former White House space advisor, and he tells about FEMA wanting to keep quiet the potential of a mega quake that would shake the whole country. And his arguments are very smooth and calm, but when you look at it, I think it's probably meaning New Madrid. But you've got an official here telling you the big one is out there, and FEMA's covering it up. We've all suspected that, but this is just a guy saying something about it. And I found another fault line of interest. It's the northeastern part of the United States.
Is this the one in Pennsylvania? The new one? There was a crack in eastern Pennsylvania that was the result of a old fault line that was being rejuvenated, apparently.
That might be connected to it. It's close. The USGS put out this report, they were basing it on stuff happening in Virginia. But what they're finding is that parts of our craton underneath the United States here are flaking and falling off and down into the magma beneath. So it's kind of like it's caving in. You know, the parts that are supposed to be real stable are flaking off and dropping into the mantle. And they've used seismic detonations and stuff like that to be like a CAT scan of the Earth's surface, and that's how they're finding these things. But I don't think I'd be liking to live in, you know, the New England states. It says the North American plate is peeling off and sinking into the mantle. You can link to that article, you know, from the website, from the show. I'm just saying, I just think it's another nail in the coffin of people say, oh, no, there's nothing going to happen. It's just rubbish. It's happening right underneath our noses. Yeah.
You know what since we're talking on this subject, and one thing that I'm trying to reconcile in my head and trying to really understand this is Joe researches the technological aspect of things. My question to you, Stan, is, the mark, any ideas on how this will come about? I mean, I understand, for example, if you don't take the mark, you can't buy or sell. I understand all the basics. I guess the execution of that, where people would they line up to get the mark? Would they? I'm just really trying to figure this out.
Look at it this way. Down in Florida, when they announce over the radio, there's a dirty big hurricane coming that's going to wipe out the coast. What happens in the next 24 hours? People rush to get, you know, food, Brussels sprouts in a can or whatever. They clean the shelves in panic. But they all get out and they form lines to get this stuff.
Right.
When our economy collapses, when the banks are closed, when the U.S. dollar currency is not acceptable anymore by, you know, being inflated or by being told it's no longer legal tender, when that happens, people are going to panic. And to help the people of the planet, an emergency digital system will come into place, and all you got to do is line up like you were getting water for a hurricane or something. Line up, come in, get the stamp, and automatically we'll give you so many credits into your digital account, into the New World Bank, because the whole banking system's collapsing. And, you know, that way you won't lose your home, and that way you'll be able to get paid for your work, and everything will be okay. Do you see how that would go down quite easily?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do.
People don't know any better. They've got mortgages. They've got bills to pay and stuff, and want to do things, and suddenly they can't get to their money, or their savings, or their 401k, or anything. And we can help you out. Comes the offer, join the digital system, and this one, people can't cheat on, like your credit cards, because you'll have your own personal ID number on you, and you're going to be safe. It's an offer they can't refuse.
Let me take a step backward and ask this. Would there be any component to this Mark of the Beast system that would be involuntarily applied to man? For example, let's say some type of a reagent or something into one's DNA from aerial spraying or something that would not just dumb down a person or make one.
Well, yeah, let's put it like this. Say it's a chip, right?
Help me out.
And you have a heart attack, you're unconscious, and while you're unconscious, the ambulance comes and they put a chip in you while you're in the hospital getting care against your will, without your knowledge.
Yeah, without your knowledge.
No, okay. I don't believe that can be the case. I think the Bible is very clear.
So, Stan, I guess what you're saying is, all right, financial devastation out the wazoo. You got a choice. You either take the chip because that's what we need to do, or you're not going to eat, you're not going to work, you're not going to survive, and worse than that, we might just round you up and cut your head off, basically, right? I mean, that's simple, correct?
Yeah, look, it doesn't even have to cut your head off. I mean, if you can't buy, and work and pay your property taxes on what you do own, if you can't do that, you're going to just atrophy. You're going to starve to death and become a homeless person out there in the bush somewhere because you can't integrate with the system. They don't need to track you down. You'll just kind of wither and fade away.
Yeah, and become an outcast, I'm sure,
unless,
by your own.
Unless you've done some prep work. You know, if you've got stuff stored someplace you can use. But even there, you've got to have a place that you can't own, a property that can't be in your name, and so you got to squat somewhere with all that stuff.
Hmm. Okay.
Oh, it's squatting. Sorry, go on.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, I just, again, people might characterize that question as really oversimplified, but I don't think so. I think just to conceptualize the potential there. And I don't mean to belabor the point here, but I just want to, I just wanted to kind of in my head give me a scenario, and I think you're right. I think it's the simplest answer is in this case the most accurate one. Go ahead, sir.
Occam's razor. I was talking about the squatting. Did you see where Obama and his housing secretary Julian Castro are trying to put a bill for before Obama steps out of office, if he does, where they're going to give credit or dividend slips, or, you know, like money in essence, to poor people so that they can move into suburbs that are the suburbs of the wealthy class and white wealthy suburbs, and force the lower income people and their crime as well to be accepted into these communities, because the government's going to subsidize them living in these previously pretty low crime and nice neighborhoods. So it's just another way to absolutely destroy the American system. You know, you've paid $500,000 for your house, okay, and your neighbor has two, and one across the street. And now then a guy that's been living in a Humpy or in his car for years or whatever gets a little credit slip from the government and says, okay, he's entitled to buy a house next door to your next-door neighbor in your neighborhood. And, he's going to put all these rusty car parts out in the front yard, and his crime and drug lord guys are going to visit him in your neighborhood. I'm not in favor of that. I mean, the neighborhood values will go down the tubes. Crime will go up. They've already tried it in Dallas, this wonderful idea of his, and it didn't work. And that's... I cannot understand people not protesting this kind of nonsense. Anyway.
Yeah. That whole story, that whole idea. In fact, folks, go to the show images page on standale.com. Click on that. An article from the New York Post about Obama's last act is to force suburbs to be less white, less wealthy. Talk about social engineering, man.
Yeah. I watched a documentary here the other night on one of the History Channel or something on the rise of Nazism and how they did it, how they Hitler's propaganda guy came out very easily at the beginning how to paint the Jewish people as not the best, and that they should be moved out of the community or labeled with a yellow star, and bit by bit the German people, who were nice people, church going people, started to accept the fact that their neighbor might be an insurrectionist or some Jewish conspirator or something. And bit by bit, over the weeks that Nazis were taking over and getting rid of the Jews, you could see how they would try this thing and that thing. Some worked. Some people made an outcry that getting rid of these people might turn to getting rid of Germans as well, and he assured them, no, that won't happen. It's just these people that are bad, these Jewish people. And you can just see how people started to believe the lie, because not to believe it would have been too painful, because they would be next. And so they didn't stand up when their neighbor was taken away and his house was looted by the SS. We're in that same position here. The reason I bring it up is because Americans are like the frogs in the slow boil pot, We're just being cooked, and people are not aware of it.
It's very true.
And that's how they get things done. They can't, there will come a time when it will be a rapid convergence, but subtlety is their game, and that's how they've been able to implement and will continue to implement these systems and
to bring about this change in what they call social justice and sustainable development is through incremental changes. And now we're reaching the point where these incremental changes aren't so incremental. You know, we see the homosexual marriage and now the transgender issues, the hypocrisy of the politically correct nature of things. It seems to be, as Greg Jackson mentioned in the first 2 hours he was on, you know, it seems like God is continuing to separate his people from the rest of the world, or his people are separating from the rest of the world, or seeing it for what it is. And I think that's a good thing, you know, in a way. It one excellent thing to bring to come through all this darkness is that people who would continue to go about their lives like everything was normal are waking up to these things and hopefully making the proper changes, which is drawing closer to the Lord. Otherwise, they're going to fall to the other side, because we know you can't be indifferent. You're going to have to be with God or against Him.
The sheep from the goats.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, I
know. It's very true.
I know. You know, I was I got an email from somebody. I get lots of emails, and they had a link to some video a guy was doing about. He seemed to know what he was talking about, but I don't think so. But he was saying that, well, you know, the sun's burned up all of its hydrogen, the majority of it, and it's now switched over to helium. Started in 1993. Of course, there's no evidence I can find that happened, but I do know that in 1991, our sun did undergo a nuclear chemistry change where it started emitting more ultraviolet and some of the infrared spectrum as well. If you look into the age of the universe, like I've talked about before, being a lot less, like in thousands of years rather than billions, because of the way we date the universe by the speed of light, electromagnetic radiation, of course, from the Big Bang till now, the speed of light's diminished so much that we can say that a star, like our sun, is going to go through its stages to death in thousands of years rather than millions or billions. So it becomes important to see what this guy was saying, whether it's true or not, and to understand the stages that a star goes through. And I've put a link in that picture there in the the third row middle image there that shows evolution of the sun. And it's a paper out of Cornell University where they talk about how it starts out with a hydrogen core and burns for 4.5 billion years. And then it creates helium, you know, byproducts, and the helium is then consumed and becomes a red giant and explodes out and consumes its satellite planets and things like that. But the reason that this is important is if we're having a shorter time period than millions and billions of years, like they show and teach in the university, when our sun does switch over to helium, and the Russians have said that we've already burned over half of our hydrogen supply back in, 20, 30 years ago they said that, and that means that pretty soon our sun is going to switch and start making helium fusion reactions, which will change the range of visible and invisible light frequencies coming out, you know, electromagnetic frequencies coming out of the sun toward us, which is probably at that point in time where the Bible says that the heat will burn men and they will hide in caves and underground to hide from the face of the Almighty, but, you know, who has caused the sun to shine so bright. But this might be this change coming up. It's another little thing to consider. And I look at this more realistically than I look at Planet X-type arguments, because I've not seen that proved yet. So watch the sun and look for what they call the irradiance factor and the solar irradiance, IR.
Okay.
R-A-D-I-N-C-E, I think it is irradiance. Anyway, that will tell us as it starts to emit more light, and I think it's going to undergo this change from fission to fusion with the helium and create a problem for the whole solar system. In fact, all the planets heating up, I think, is indicative of increased output from the sun in the infrared and ultraviolet already. Fascinating stuff.
Okay, so just so I'm understanding this, what you're saying is this has not yet started, right?
I don't think so. The early early signs of it, I think, occurred in 1991 when these two new spectra started emitting from the sun. Something was changing the chemical reaction in the sun. It's a nuclear chemistry, but it was changing. And although it didn't increase skin cancers and that kind of stuff, the increased radiation told us that something is starting.
Got it.
And I think, going by biblical prophecy, that if we're at the beginning of the tribulation period, if you look at the book of Revelation, the sun plays a big part in a lot of the judgments that will befall mankind that's unrepentant.
Yeah, it burns up a third of the people, I believe, and a third of the green grass.
Back to what he was saying before, or in the previous program, Stan.
And Enoch talks about it, and Isaiah mentions it, how the sun will become seven times brighter than it once was. The moon, due to the sun's brightness increase, the moon will also change.
You know what, Stan?
Sun at daytime, but the moon, it'll be the moon instead. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Sorry,
I gotta ask this before we get to the end of the program. Mercury's transit, which happens a dozen times per century, anything being oministic or pretending from the transit of Mercury across the sun?
Well, not that I know of. I mean, a number of people have said, you know, oh, this is a sign of this or that, but I personally haven't seen anything that excited me. I mean, that's just a normal orbital thing. I've seen some neat photography of the event, and of planes also, you know, with a sun background and things like that. But no, it's not an abnormal occurrence.
Okay.
Somewhere back in, I don't know whether it's in Ezekiel, Isaiah, where it talks about the sun will be covered with a cloud. That's another thing that tells you that there's going to be debris. Either the sun is going to throw off a cloud of, heavy ions, or the metallic ions that it puts into the solar wind. Maybe it's going to release a lot of those as it increases its diameter slightly, and it'll make a cloud around the sun and between us and the sun. That cloud would obscure the light, so that the light coming from the sun and hitting the moon would be so weakened that it would be reddish colored from that. I'm trying to remember where it was, as I say, in the Old Testament, but it does say that a cloud will envelop the sun, and whether we pass through something in the galactic rim that's a cloud, or whether it's generated by the chemistry change in the sun itself, there will be a cloud there in addition to it growing very bright. Which comes first is, you know, maybe up for debate. I don't know. But anyway, that's something else to look for in addition to the heat. It just affects so many things. The radiation coming out of the sun is absorbed by phytoplankton, the very little tiny sea animals and stuff that the whale eat, the krill. All these things absorb solar radiation in certain frequencies, and it's like energy to them. And they create a byproduct of heat once they've absorbed this light, and their metabolism, burns their food. And it heats up the oceans. And this causes, polar melt. This causes a lot of things, that currents change and salt water plumes and things. Everything changes as the heat is raised. And just by raising the temperature of these little tiny life forms gets us.
Well,
Stan, we have reached the end of this hour and of our show for this evening. Once again, I want to give our appreciation to you and Holly, and say that we're thankful and happy that you were able to join us again this week, and that the pain that you were going through has subsided. And we'll ask the audience and ourselves to continue to keep you and Holly in our prayers.
Amen.
And that pain stays away. I'm sure it's got to be a lot to keep you down and keep you from doing what you like and love to do. So
Ezekiel 32:7 covers the sun with a cloud, the moon shall not give her light. That's the one we're looking for. Sorry, go on. Yep.
Oh, this is good. Ezekiel 32:7. Thank you for that. All right, brother. Thank you so much for coming on tonight. All right, bud.
Give Holly our best. See you next week.
All right.
Tomorrow, Steve Quayle, Gary Haven, the guy behind the movie Armageddon on its release day, or release week.
Friday, Paul McGuire, too.